I'm Sandy. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know I was the first 10-minute speaker, so I thought I had 10 more minutes to kill. Anyhow, I told Mike I'd volunteer to read something, and he told me I was going to talk for 10 minutes. First of all, I don't know. He didn't ask if there were any people here in the first 30 days of sobriety, but are there any newcomers out there tonight? Anyone in the first few days of sobriety? Well, anyhow, you probably don't want to raise your hand, but... If I talk to anyone tonight, I really hope I can talk to the newcomer tonight. I haven't had a chance to give any, well, to give much back to AA in the last year or so, and I felt that maybe I was asked to share tonight to give something back because I've certainly got a lot out of this program. I came into AA, I just had my 6-year birthday on the 9th of February, and... when I came in here 6 years ago, I was a whole different person. The way I felt completely unloved. I didn't feel that I really was ever loved in my whole life. I felt very unworthy and just, I had no self-esteem or self-worth at all. I felt that I was such a bad person and all the things I'd done through my drinking. I really felt like a scum. When I came into AA, it was the first time that I felt genuinely loved, and I felt unconditional love. I felt that the people there, they didn't judge me. They didn't care about my past. In fact, they encouraged me to get together with one other person who we call a sponsor and share the things that I had done, the deep, dark secrets that I had kept to myself that made me feel that I was worthless to another human being. And once I did that, I realized that there is a God in my life, and He does love me, and He does forgive me. I still struggle to forgive myself for things that I do today. But I got an idea for the first time that that I was loved and forgiven. And accepted. I felt like I belonged for the first time. The people in the meetings, I could listen to them talk, and right away I could relate to them. It was just a great comfort to know that there is somebody out there in this other, in the world that felt like I felt and thought like I felt. God, I need a meeting. I can't wait till the main speaker talks. Well, when I came, for the first time, I started to really live. Life became worth living. Before, it was just a lot of depression, a lot of self-hatred, and a lot of hate for everybody else out there in the world. I didn't have a very big perspective on... Everything was just very narrow. You know, I only saw straight ahead, and I didn't see to either side. And usually all I saw was black, and I saw bad things that were going to happen to me. And since I've been sober, I've been growing in more ways than I could even begin to tell you about. I'm beginning to love myself today. I can't say that I love myself. You know, there are times when I can say I love myself, but it's a day-to-day process. I know that I'm lovable today. I know that I'm loved. I know that I'm forgiven. I know I have a chance today, and I have hope, and that's something that I didn't have when I came here. I didn't have any hope for anything. That's what AA's given me, is hope. Yeah. I know that there's a way out. And sobriety, I can say that the compulsion to drink was taken away after I started to work the steps. But the day-to-day living is still a is a difficult struggle. You know, life hasn't gotten any easier to live just because I quit drinking. And I know as long as I want to continue to stay sober, I have to do the things that the people in these meetings suggest to do. I still have to call people. I need to go to meetings. I need to work the steps. That's the only thing I've ever found that's helped me. And I know that it's going to be a lifelong process. And that's okay with me because I know it's the only thing that works. And I don't really feel I have anything else to say except I feel privileged to be up here to share with you. And I hope that I was able to give something back tonight because I've gotten my whole life back from you people. And I want to welcome the newcomers. And I want to say, give this a chance, give it your all, because it's worth it, and it works. And I don't think there's anything else out there that you're going to find in books or anything that's going to save your life the way AA saved my life. And just want to welcome everybody and enjoy yourselves. That's it.
Thank you, Seth. Thank you, Sandy. And now I'd like to introduce our second 10-minute speaker, and that is Mildred.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mildred, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I'm a geriatric alcoholic. I didn't know I was going to speak tonight, and usually when people ask me to share, recently, they've been catching me in a depressed state of mind, which is something we all have to work through, and we can do this with the steps in this program. But it's taken me a long time to get to where I am today, and I needed every pill and I needed every drink to be exactly where I am. Thank heavens we have steps 6 and 7. Particularly for a cocky bitch like me. I mean, we need it. I'm still so arrogant that I do my crossword puzzles in ink. Another thing I'm famous for, if the power fails because of the weather, you'll hear me in the back without the mic. Because the neighbors, you know, I was told that I could be heard in 3 counties when I started to take off while I was drinking. I couldn't even whisper quietly, so, you know, that's the way it is. We hear people say that it's an adventure, and it sure as hell is. This is a wonderful group with a lot of fun, and I wish that I had been able to go to many more conferences, and I've not been able to do that, but I have a friend who was kind enough to invite me, and that's why I'm here. So there's a message here that maybe I should start doing some more sharing. I know there's one thing that I've been procrastinating about, and that's H&I. For the last couple of years, I've been thinking about doing it, but I wanted to hear somebody talk about that, and I was fortunate enough to hear Little Petty talking about this down somewhere else in this whole complex. God, this place is large, isn't it? Well, if there's anybody out there that isn't sure they're an alcoholic, how many of those are out there? Because I was one of those. And I didn't follow direction. I was going to do it my way. And so I did it my way. For about 18 months, I was very busy. I was doing the coffee, doing the chairs, being the secretary, the greeting, and I into all sorts of things. And I was well on my way to being Mrs. AA, I guess. I'm glad that didn't work out. I thought that I could handle anything. And somewhere along the line, people say that those of us that think we're so strong and indestructible, we're the ones that have a hell of a time getting this simple program. We've got to overanalyze, pull everything apart, and change a few things too, I mean, after all, we, this book, the way it's written, and all sorts of things. And that's what we call contempt before, I knew you had the answer. So that's the way it was. And I didn't even realize what I was doing. But I guess some of us that are new in the program, when we start out, we think that, well, we can bring our expertise to all these good people and we'll show them how to handle this. Wow. Well, after 18 months, when I thought I was no longer toxic, and it's taken a few years to learn that I was toxic a long time, I decided to have a drink, and I did. Well, without getting too dramatic about the thing, because I'm over the drama too, that's a big help. In no time at all, I was right back in the corner, right back in the same despair, right back in the same hatred. And as I look back now, I didn't hear a hell of a lot because I was just so full of rage. I wasn't angry. I was just outraged. I was so full of rage and hatred that I couldn't hear anything. And that no one could tell me how to do anything. I was the typical know-it-all, new person in the program that is so difficult for good people in AA who try to help. So the ladies discovered that this was the way it was, and they permitted me to do it my way. And it didn't work. Well, this works. I met a woman who said something to me that sort of helped to make the pennies drop, you know? Suddenly one day all the pennies drop and you wonder, how is it I never understood that before? And she said, well, just think of ABC. Oh, as we read it, how it works, just think of ABC. Certainly no human power, I learned, could help me with my alcoholism. I learned that. And it seems to be that I have to learn everything the hard way. I'm a hard nose and maybe I'm getting a little softer. I'm less intense, I can say that. And I don't get quite as angry as I used to. But I have to avoid hearing or watching or learning anything about the decadent hill in Washington, D.C. I have to keep my mind away from all of those people because I get upset. And besides, it's none of my business. And it's very easy to be a second guesser when you're out here. Well, I better not go into that. 10 minutes is a long time, isn't it? I appreciate Sandy saying what she did, because all of that and more is something that I try to remember. I try very hard, and I pray for balance, because when I got back to California 10 years ago, I was completely out of control, and I was a menace to myself and to everyone around me. And one thing that I learned early on was I was really surprised to learn how much violence I had within me. And so I can understand very well why we have so many people in our prisons because of alcohol and drugs. This is some hell of a disease. It really, I had no idea what I was doing to myself with those tranquilizers and alcohol, abusing both. I was a workaholic as well. I put in many, many hours, and even in that capacity, I thought I knew it all as well. Give me the reins for 5 minutes and I'll straighten out this corporation. You know. But that's only one of the benefits that I've gotten out of AA is the fact that I don't know it all. In fact, the longer I stay around here, I know I know that I don't know anything, really. But I try to keep in mind three words from our Serenity Prayer. That's accept, courage, and wisdom. Well, it took a long time for me to learn how to accept, and my denial was fantastic. I was just—it's insurmountable, I thought. And I thought that I could never be a part of this. And then one kind woman kept saying, "You've got it." And I said, "No, I haven't got it. I'll never get it. I'll never get it." Negativity was just all over me, and it was just so hard to get rid of that. And it's kind of strange, because I was always very positive about so many things. And I came in here to learn how weak I really was. I was not anti-mame. I was not super mom. And I was destructible. And I had a hell of a lot of fear. But I didn't dare let any of you know that. And that's kind of where I have been for a long time, learning how to let down all these barriers that we build over the years that destroy us in the end. And learning how to be, and not minding to be, vulnerable. Oh dear, that's a big one. And that no one in this program is going to hurt anyone. No one here will hurt any other alcoholic. Learning how to trust, that takes a lot of time as well. And dealing with rejection and abandonment and all the other things that we get into, it takes time. So as Sandy said, stick around, let the miracle happen. If it's difficult to sit in that seat, oh, give yourself another 5 minutes, and then when that arrives, take another five, and suddenly you'll be around for a half an hour or an hour, and maybe some of this will rub off. I hope that I can one day be the kind of woman that my sponsor was. Now, maybe some of you knew her. Judy Steiger in San Francisco, and she died in October. And if I wind up with one-tenth of that woman's compassion and guidance for someone in the program, I'll consider myself having done a fairly good day's work. And thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Mildred. Well, I personally want to thank the person that called Ken D and let him know that what the proper freeway was, how to get here, and when the meeting started, because personally I was almost 25 minutes late. I mean, 8:30 is 8:30 to me. And with that, I'd like to introduce our main speaker from La Mesa, California, Mr. Ken D.
Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here with all you sickies. I want to thank Michael and all the folks who are responsible for getting me here. I got that nice room out in Placerville. If I hitchhike real good, I can be here in a half hour. And they sent up a nice bowl of fruit and a Corvette. I mean, it was nice. It's a nice little shot. I'm from New York, so every now and again I run my words together. In New York, we take sentences and we break them down to like one word, like, did you eat becomes jeet, J-E-E-T, you know? So if I slip into that, if I forget I'm from San Diego and I flip into that, just say he's very, very sick and I'm probably not going to get well. I come from a family where divided into two groups, either you're in AA or you need it. I'm the youngest of seven, and my mom said the only time us kids ever said no to a drink is if we misunderstood the question. You know, it's just that simple. Sometimes, you know, Mildred was alluding to what goes on in Washington. I always liked Nancy Reagan. I thought she had that great saying, you know, just say no. I said, why didn't I think of that, you know? God, Nancy, you're just too late for me. Now she's working on the homeless issue. She says, just buy a house. But you know, sometimes I come into these little bozo meetings and you hear people share and they say, you know, there's us in here and there's normal people out there. Watch my lips, as the president says. There are no normal people. There are just folks who haven't shared with you, you know? It's just that simple. I'll tell you how people are. I flew up here on a plane. They never mention when you fly on a plane the middle seat. When you make your reservations, they always say, you want a window seat or an aisle seat? It's like that middle seat doesn't exist. And somehow you're always in it, you know? You know, oh no, I want the middle seat with two heavyset guys perspiring all the way up to Sacramento. You know, that's what I want, you know? And then you get in your seat. You've been on planes. There's absolutely no way to move. And the guy on the inside looks at you and he says, can I sneak by you? Hey, wait a half hour. I might doze off, you know, but, you know, there's absolutely no way you're going to sneak by me now. You just told me. I mean, but that's the world I live in, you know. It's like, and then people say there's normal people. There are no normal people. I go into a little store and I cash a check because I wanted to buy some Christmas stuff. I don't write a whole lot of checks. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. They used to say, money talks, but cash screams. And so I had a bunch of stuff, and I wrote a check, and the little clerk says, just a moment. And she calls over this guy, and he sizes me up and down, and then he okays it. And I said, how can you okay it? You don't know me any better than she does, you know? She might know me 2-3 minutes longer. So then he looks at me in his logical mind and says, you better give me your phone number. Now, do you think if I'm giving you a bad check, I'm going to give you my right phone number? Come on. I mean, I look at these people and say, their shorts must be too tight. You know, like, and that's the way the world we live in. And it's totally illogical. And people say, well, I'm going to figure it out. You see a toothpaste commercial, what do you see? You see a guy brushing his teeth. You see a shampoo commercial, the guy shampooing his hair. They do a tampon commercial, you see two women playing tennis. What the hell is that? You know, like, then they tell me I need meetings. I mean, but I got the kind of mind that just does that kind. You know, I notice all this stuff today. When I was growing up and I saw people throwing up and falling down, I didn't know those were coming attractions. And but now today, I'm tuned into all this stuff going around. And it's like I go out and I'll blow $100 on something that's totally irrelevant. I don't need it worth a hoot. And then I'll come home. This is my mind. And I'll take that $2 tube of toothpaste and I'll squeeze it so hard that sometimes it will pop out. When I go to put it on, it pops back in, you know? And you say, why don't you just throw this away? You just blew $100 on nothing, you know? But somehow I gotta, you know, that's the way we equate things, you know? We do this kind of stuff. So if you're sitting here, watch my lips, okay? It's real important. This is the most important thing I'm gonna say. That every problem I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous has always started with these three words. I've been thinking. You know? I I never heard anyone say, boy, I was meditating and was I overpowered with fear. No. And if you leave an alcoholic alone to think for a long time, you might as well just commit him. You know, it's like, it's just crazy. You know, that's the way it is. But that's the way, you know, when folks come in here, and Mildred alluded to it, they want to analyze. You know, I read the big book. We have some guys, we read the big book together because sometimes it's like confusion. And the big book says, some of us try to hold on to our old ideas. Okay? Pretty simple. And the result was nil. It says we had to let go absolutely. And someone looks at you and says, what does that mean? No. Let's read it again. We had to let go absolutely. Does that throw you off or what? I mean, that means all the stuff you brought with you isn't worth a hoot. You have to jettison it. Sometimes people get the idea you got to learn a lot of new stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just the opposite. You got to unlearn all that old stuff. You got get rid of that stuff that never worked. You know, I have my own simple philosophy of life. That is, leap before you look. By the time you sit down and figure it out what you're going to do, you could have tried it. You guys got a sign, the courage to change. I have people that say things like, Ken, I've been thinking about change. I know I have to change. I'm praying about change. I'm inventorying change. I'm talking to you and others about change. I'm sharing at meetings about change. Come on, you know? It's like watching somebody milk a mouse. I mean, how long are you going to hold on to that? And they stand there and they look at you like they have no idea what you're talking about. And now the big thing is to go back and document the fact that you had a terrible childhood. I'm not doubting that some people did. But your perception of what happened when you were 5, 6, 7, and 8, how reliable is it 30, 40 years later? You know? You want to take it to the bank? You know? I don't know about anybody else, but my program has become so terribly simple that it's nauseating. It really is. Because the answers here are real simple. People talk to me about there and then, and I immediately stop them and say, there is no there or then. There and then does not exist. There's only here and now. And this now is the only place that you can meet God. That's why the book says, there is one who has all power. May you find him now. It doesn't say tomorrow, next week, the day after when it's convenient. You know, God gave alcoholics minds so that they could think, and in that way they confused that with accomplishing something. You know? When you are thinking, you are doing nothing. You want to sit here tonight and say, well, I know there's a John in the back of that room, and I have to go. And you can inventory it and think about it, but I'm going to suggest that you get up and boogie. You know? Otherwise, someone's going to be messed up in your seat, you know? And that's just the way it is. And you watch people say, I'm thinking. Oh, please. It's like Russian roulette, and there's 8 bullets in a 6-shooter, you know? Alcoholics do not know how to let go. We want to hold on to all that stuff. We don't know how to surrender gracefully. You know, they tell a story of the alcoholic who came out of the bar, and he'd been drinking. He was terribly loaded. And there was a gold miner going through town, and he had a mule, and the alcoholic looked at him and pulled out his guns, and he said, do you know how to dance? And the gold miner said, no, sir, I don't. He said, well, you better learn. And he started shooting, and the gold miner was dancing, and finally you hear click, click. He was out of bullets. And the gold miner smiled and reached onto his pack mule and pulled out a 12-gauge shotgun. And he said, do you ever kiss a mule's ass? And the alcoholic said, no, but I always wanted to. You know, like, you know. When I look back on my life, the thing that comes terribly clear to me is that I was afraid to live life. And being afraid to live life, I developed a bunch of defense mechanisms, which supposedly gave me a sense of security and held life out here. Held life out here. Mildred touched on this also. And the deal is today, all I want to do and all I feel I have to do is say yes to life. And you guys taught me that here. Do you want what we have? Yes. Are you willing to go to any length to get it? Yes. Are you willing to let go of your old ideas? Yes. Are you willing to clean up your side of the street and let everybody off the hook who ever hurt you? Yes. And that's a selfish yes, because when I let others off the hook, I get off the hook. As long as I'm dealing with a resentment and anger about some person and some event that's already happened, I'm on the hook. I want off the hook. There's a chapter in my big book. It says, a vision for you. It's not a fantasy for you. By the way, I have to congratulate you women. You look terrific coming in. I mean, I'm not going to run over. I'm going to get you out of here for that 13-step dance. But I saw some of the nicest trolling outfits. I mean, one gal had on that short leather look. Does that come with a baton? You know, like they're going to weigh us. That was just so feminine. In the 60s, women were going through a revolutionary period. They dressed like Che Guevara, you know, it was like all that guerrilla stuff. So it's nice to see women being feminine. So I'll get you out of here on time. Pick out your targets now, you know. You don't need Miss Right, just Miss Right now. You know? If you knew Miss Perhaps, I don't know, I don't know. But in this chapter, A Vision for You, there's a powerful line. And what it says is that someday the alcoholic will be unable to imagine life with alcohol or without it. And then it says, at that point he will know lonesomeness as few do. He'll be at the jumping off point. He'll wish for the end. And then the next sentence is real powerful. It says, we have shown how we have gotten out from under. All you have to say is, yes, I'm willing. Do you have a substitute for his alcoholism? Yes, we have the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have something that will fire your imagination, give you something to live for, have a primary purpose. You don't get up in the morning and wonder like, well, what's going to hurt me today? You know, you're saying, those poor devils, I'm still here. You know, it's like, I mean, I listen to people say things like, when I get up in the morning, it's fear, and I shake, and I lay in bed, and I'm overcome, and I'm underwhelmed, and, you know. I don't know about you guys, but I'm totally unscarred by education. Most of the guys I grew up with think that Moby Dick is a venereal disease, you know. But at one time in my life, I had 4 years in a state institution. And during that time, I had a chance to do tremendous amounts of reading. And I can tell you, 97% of the people who die in this country die laying down. So when my alarm goes off in the morning, guess what I do? I get up. And once I'm up, I want to go screw something up. I don't want to lose my skills, you know? And I hear people say things like, well, supposing I make a mistake, Ken, or supposing I do it wrong, or do you watch the news? The air we breathe in the L.A. air, you have to chew first. You know? The food we eat is full of all kinds of stuff that's cancerous. I'm from New York. Any day I expect an 800-pound deformed fish to come out of the Hudson River and say, I want to see somebody from Dow Chemical right now, you know? Like, And you're worried about making a mistake. We're counting on you making mistakes. And then once I'm up, I sleep in the buff, and I have by my bed a trampoline. So as soon as I get up, I turn on the theme from Rocky. And it starts out like, dan da 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 da. And I jump on my trampoline looking in the mirror. I told this story in Greeley, Colorado. Now they've given me a Stetson cowboy hat, so I wear that. And I'm jumping up and down, and that's the way I start my day. And I figure, you know, I get to laugh at me first, and then I'll catch up with you guys later. You know, like, And people are looking for all kinds of things, thinking about all kinds of things. And really all you have to do here is, there's another big book I read. It's the original big book. And in there it says, be still and know that I am God. And when I first arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, being still for this alcoholic was a death-defying act. You know, I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how to do a lot of things. I was married at the time, and my wife and children, for their own sanity and protection, had moved out of state. You know, it was a wise move. You know, I was in the process of going to jail again because I had a habit of finding things when I was drinking before people officially lost them. You know, I wish they had had these telephone machines that are real popular today when I was drinking. I really did. You know, I could hear my recording. Hi, this is Ken. Sorry about the check. You know, and the deal was is that when I was also living with my mom in a senior citizen home, and I was the only one under 65 breathing in this place, and I had been there so long I had learned to use the walker. You know, and my mom's name was Trudy, and the little bitty patrol used to come in the morning for coffee. And they'd say, is he still here, Trudy? Like, I couldn't hear, you know, right in the middle of the living room on a couch. And she'd say, yes, but I know he's going to get better. And then she'd go off and spend her day, and I would just do dastardly things. And the day before, my sobriety date is July 5th of 70. And the day before I arrived here, July 4th, my mom went to visit my sister, and I didn't want to go. I was incapable of going. I was incapable of moving. And I had several day growth of beard, and I had a lot of judgments out and a lot of warrants, and things weren't good in my life. And I was hurting a lot of innocent people who didn't deserve to be hurt because they were just real, real nice people. And I was watching cartoons, which I was apt to do. And my wife had been gone about 3-6 months at that time. And so I was watching the Flintstones. And I noticed that Wilma had a cute ass. You know? Now, don't get me wrong. She was nowhere near as nice as Mrs. Jetson. But you start to notice those kind of things. And the next day, I went to an AA meeting. Fortunately. And I walked into this meeting, and I had shaved, and I had a blue wool suit, and I put that blue wool suit on. I was back in New York, July 4th. And when I got to the door, a guy said to me, newcomer. That was before I realized how intuitive you were, you know. And I said, yes, this is my first meeting. And so they brought me in and they sat me down. And back there, the meetings are only an hour long. They start at 9, they end at 10. They used to say, no soul saved after 10. And at 10 o'clock when the meeting was over, this guy came over to me and talked to me. And he gave me a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Told me to take it home and read it. And I took that book home, and that night I opened it up. Starting at the beginning, I started to read. And what I read in that book was that for the first time I had an owner's manual. You know? I never had an owner's manual before. I didn't know what made me tick, why I did certain things. But in reading that book, answers began to jump off the page to me. And it became very evident to me that these folks knew something about me. I always felt when I was a kid growing up that I would someday live my life in such a way that somewhere, somehow, someone would want to write a book about me. And they did. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was right there. And I grew up in an environment, my mom did a real great job. My dad died when I was young, and she raised kids, and she did a great job. There's never any doubt in my mind that she loved us. If it came down to someone going without, her number always came up. And when I was growing up, they used to call it the slums. You lived in the slums. And then around 50s or 60s, we had something called sociologists. Then it wasn't the slums anymore. Then you came from the ghetto. The ghetto. And now they say inner city. He's an inner city kid. Yeah. It's the same joint. You know, it hasn't gotten any better. And the deal was, is I used to be in conferences where people were talking as though I weren't there. What do you think we should do with them? And the answers are always the same. You know, let's keep the rest of the neighborhood safe. But I grew up, as I said, it was a mostly predominantly Italian neighborhood. And all the guys who had money in my neighborhood were called Don. And they used to have a saying, if he fell asleep in the trunk of a car, he deserved to be shot. You know, that was... And people used to say things like, how far is it to the subway? We go, we don't know, no one's ever made it. You know, like... And if it was small, we took it. And if it was too big to take, we lay down next to it and try to claim it. You know? And so I learned at an early age how to go and get things. No one taught me. My family, my mom would have fallen over if she'd known some of the stuff I was doing. But I remember one of those events that you kind of sticks in your mind. In the old days, you used to be able to go into we used to call them Salamaries, little delis on the corner, grocery stores. And you'd walk in and they always had a slip for you and you could buy some things and charge it. And when you got paid, you paid them. And you ran a tab, more or less, at the grocery store. And this particular day I went in and ours was too high, and so the guy said, you can't have what you have in the basket there, you gotta put it back. Your mom owes too much. And it wasn't like I needed that stuff, but it was like I had to go home then and tell my mom we couldn't get it because we couldn't afford it. So I decided to go make some money. And in my neighborhood we had lots of ways to make money. I began to run numbers. I ran them in school, I ran them after school. Then I learned how to jumpstart a truck. Then I learned how to get into model homes. Then I learned how to take things like furniture and washers and dryers. I was doing more moving than... It got so people called me up and said, you know, if you can get me a green washer-dryer combo, give me a call, you know. And so I began to just do stuff. And in school, of course, I wasn't getting along too good because you had to write compositions about, how did you spend your summer, Ken? You know, like, well, I knocked over this. I jump-started that. You know, it was a different world. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was totally confused what life was all about. Totally confused. I had a lot of guilt. I don't know where it came from. You know, I was kind of like Mr. Mouse. Mr. Mouse was out cruising the bars one night, and he meets Mrs. Elephant. He picks her up and he takes her home and they have passionate love all night long. And in the morning when Mr. Mouse gets up, he's rubbing his eyes and he looks over and there's Miss Elephant. She's on her back, her feet are in the air, she's dead as a doornail. And Mr. Mouse goes, wow, one night of fun and I spend the rest of my life digging a grave, you know, like a... And that's what I thought. I thought I had one night of fun and missed it, and I was spending, I'm going to have to spend my life digging a grave. And one of the things that I did when I first got here was I listened to what people were telling me. And my sponsor, I was sober about 6 months. I moved out of my mom's place. I moved into my own place. I had no furniture. I had orange crates. Went down, picked up a bed at the Sally and brought it home. It was like, I went to an AA meeting, and it wasn't like it was going to get okay. suddenly that night I became aware of the fact it was okay. I was sober. I hadn't drank in 6 months. The wreckage that I had created, I was starting to work on. There was some heavy stuff going to come down, but hopefully it could be worked out. And during the course of my first few meetings, I met a guy. And this guy impressed me because he had a suit. Wasn't wool. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said he wouldn't be my sponsor because he hadn't been sober long enough. He was only there a couple of months ahead of me. So the deal is that he said nix to that. And then we continued to travel around and go to meetings together, but he wasn't my sponsor. He was just someone who picked me up and gave me a ride. And about 7 or 8 months down the line, I had to go before the grand jury had said something was wrong with me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You have great words for stuff. And here they say, geographic. In my neighborhood, that was interstate flight to avoid prosecution. You know? So I had to go, and there's about 125, 130 assistant district attorneys in a city of about 9 million people, and I walk into this office, and who's sitting behind that desk but this little guy I was going to meetings with? And he looked up, and he said, "Ken, I didn't know you did this." And I said, "Let me assure you, when we were riding around and I was sharing with you, I had no idea you did this." And you hear people use the word coincidence. That's when God does a miracle and he doesn't want to take the credit for it. And so we worked this thing out, and I didn't have to go to the sneezer. And the end result of that was things just began to happen that defy any kind of explanation. My life began to get well, and all I was doing was, at that time, not drinking, going to meetings, and working with others. We didn't have 12-step calls at that time. They used to just say, "Pick this guy up and take him to a meeting." We used to call them hits. "Put the hit on this guy." You know? It was that kind of a neighborhood. You know, you say, "A hit? No, take him to a meeting." You know, but we used to sit around at the meeting and decide who we were going to put the hit on. You know, there, Larry down at the drugstore is not doing good. Okay, put the hit on him, you know. And then we'd take him to a meeting. And the deal was that you cannot unring a bell. Once you take a person to a meeting, I don't care what happens or what you think happens, you cannot unring a bell. That person's life will never be the same again. But more importantly, your life will never be the same again. And as you stay here a while, you make what I call the greatest journey of life, which is out of your head and into your heart. And it's a short distance, but it's the greatest distance that any person can travel. You begin to not ask questions. Why does not even come into your vocabulary? Why does someone do this? Why does someone? It's how can I help? What can we do to get this person off the dime? It's not why did you do this? Are you doing the same thing over? We didn't have anybody who was extremely intelligent, so we didn't have to put up with that kind of nonsense. We just had people who were there when you needed help. And when you're there, you're there. People know when you're there to help. They also know when you're just putting in your time. And you began to make that journey to the inside. And I read that poem by Robert Frost, and it said, "The woods are lovely, dark and deep, and I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep." And what that meant to me was I was going to have to get rid of the stuff on the outside that always caused me confusion and make this inward journey. And it was that the woods were lovely, dark, and deep. I had to go alone. It wasn't like a picnic where I could take a half a dozen people. I had to make this journey alone. And as I made that journey inward, my life changed dramatically for the better. I began to get, as Chuck Chamberlain once said, a new pair of eyes, a new pair of glasses. The deal is that I could hear things I never heard before and see things I never saw before. And life got very simple for me. I didn't have to go around figuring out anything. It got so simple. And all I had to do was continue to do what basically we talk about here. I really feel sorry for the folks who have a lot of education. I really do. Not that education itself is bad, but that gets in the way. They're always trying to figure stuff out. You call somebody up and you say, "Where are you? How come you haven't been to meetings?" "Well, I've been sitting home thinking." And you say, "You got a gun? Yeah, hide it." You know, we're always sitting and thinking. And when that's the mind's way of tricking us. I don't know about you. I have a feeling that your mind is the same as mine, but I can't talk to that. What I can tell you for sure is my mind is a coward. God has always been calling me forward, and I'm always finding reasons not to go. I've got to get this job done. We got to buy the house. I got to raise my kids. I got to do this. I got to do that. There's always something in the way. And the message here is so simple. Put that stuff down. Let it go. Come on. Enjoy life. Get on with it. You know, I have simple philosophies. As I said, my number one philosophy is leap before you look. The second is be a verb. We have too many nouns in AA. Be a verb, you know? Guys call me on the phone saying, "Ken, I'm home and I'm scared and I'm powerless." And I'm thinking. So I say real cruel things sometimes, like, "Hey, reread that chapter in the big book, Into Thinking, and call me back." And they say, "Ken, it's in the action. Bingo, you're on to something, you know?" You know? There's two ways to climb an oak tree. The first is to plant an acorn and sit on it. Or the other is just go and climb one, you know? And I like the people that go and climb them, you know? Just get out there and do something. So remember, it's real, real simple. Leap before you look. Be a verb. Don't scratch shit that don't itch, you know? So many people are going around looking for something wrong. "Well, I have a general malaise or something wrong. I'm having a general malaise. I just don't feel well." That's because you're not doing anything. You're just sitting and thinking. Then the other one is don't get between a dog and a hydrant. You know, just don't do that. Most of life is logistics, you know? Did you ever notice that people who constantly take the shaft first have to take the position? I mean, it's just, that's life. That's life. That's the way it is. And people don't want to see the obvious. They want to stay home and have all the results of being sober without doing anything. And God has a great plan for us. Through each and every one of us, God is trying to become something He's never been before. God doesn't make two people alike. I know our fingerprints are different. I can attest to that. If I don't get anything out of AA, it's a lot of that knowledge about that stuff and the ability to stand before one of these and not have to enter a plea, you know? I thought my life was a TV show. Let's make a deal, you know? But it gets real, real simple. You go and you work with others. And in working with others, you forget about who you are. The book talks about that over and over and over again. It says we have to be willing to get out on the firing line of life. God has a purpose for us. He wants us to work with other people. It's the greatest law of compensation there is, and that is you cannot help another human being without being helped yourself. God has the game rigged. It's not the way we do it, and it's not the motivation we use, like, "I'm going to get something out of it." We just do. I read a story about Einstein's theory of relativity. Can you imagine a bozo like me? I mean, in my neighborhood, people used to say, "There's a dead bird. We look up." You know, like. And I remember the day I said I'd like to read Einstein's theory of relativity. And they fetched it for me. But Einstein was on with a lot of good stuff. And one of the things is that time, like everything else, is relative. Time is relative. And if you're enjoying yourself, or if you're with a loved one, time flies. And if you're sitting with someone who's dying, the night seems like it will never end. And yet the clock on the wall ticks exactly the same way. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I personally, not because I'm a hard guy, but I work with a lot of people, but I won't sponsor anyone unless they've read pages 132 and 133 of the big book. I just won't. It says, we're not a glum lot. We insist on enjoying life. We have recovered and been given the power to help others. We know God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. God doesn't create my misery. I create it. God doesn't say, well, Ken's too happy today. I think I'll interfere, you know. Some guy the other day said, how do you know, at a meeting, he said, how do you know God is merciful? I said, would you consider yourself selfish? He said, yes. I said, all of your life? He said, most of it. I said, are you self-centered? He said, yes. I said, have you hurt other people? He said, yes. And these yeses go for me too. I said, have you done a lot of things that you wish you hadn't done, that you're ashamed of? He said, yes. I said, now this unmerciful God sentences you to sit in a sunny room in sunny Southern California and be punished by going to an hour of AA meetings. Is he unmerciful or what? You know, like. And guys say, Ken, how do I believe in God? I said, go to sleep. He says, what do you mean? I says, hey, you sleep for 8 hours. Somebody takes care of you. Who takes care of you? You're not conscious. You don't know what's going on. Somebody takes care of you. See, I deal with a lot of guys who are sick like me, and they go like, wow. Like, I like to work with those newcomers who say, you know, like, oh, look, it's just a thermos. You know, you put hot stuff in, it stays hot. Put cold stuff in, it stays cold. How does it know, Ken? You know, like, you know. See, I don't overshoot my mark at all. I stay right where I'm comfortable, you know. But this recovery thing is just so simple that I watch people walk right by it. They're so busy trying to figure something out, they don't see the obvious. And the obvious is, this works. And all you have to do is some simple steps. And one of them is the third step. You turn your will and your life and your care over to someone, and you don't care what you call it. Call it higher power, call it whatever you want. But you turn it over. And two things happen. Number one, you surrender, which for an alcoholic is terrific. And number two is, now that this power has control of your life, that you've given it, you no longer have to sit around and figure out what's good and what's bad. If it comes from that source, it's good. Even if I don't understand the purpose of it, it's good. You know, in 1981, my wife and I, who had separated, got back together, and we had a good run for about 10 years. And then in 81, we divorced. And she decided she wanted to go in another direction. And it was a terrifying experience for me. We had been married 22 years. I thought we had gone through all the worst of it. And here we were to the gravy, and we couldn't make it work. It was a real overpowering thing for me. And I grew up in an era a little bit before most of the young folks in this room where the songs had permanence to them, like, till the end of time, you know. I'll be loving you always. Now I was getting ready to go out and date, and they were playing songs like Beat It, Whip It, Choke It, Kill It, you know. I'll tell you the truth, I was nervous, you know, like that. I thought, whoa. And my kids stayed with me at that time, and they were older, and I remember them saying, Dad, you got to wake up and smell the coffee and go out. And I remember the first time I went on a date. Now, not to belabor this, but the last time I had asked a woman out, Eisenhower was president. And so here I was going out dating. So I dated the only way I knew. I bought flowers and candy, and I went to call on this gal. And when I rang the doorbell, she answered the door and she started laughing. And then she told me she wasn't laughing at me, she was laughing with me. She said, you know, Ken, she said, you're Ricky Nelson in a John Travolta world, you know. But it was a deal where I had to start to do something that I didn't think I'd ever have to deal with. And that's happened to me over and over and over again in Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1983, I decided I wanted to work in another area, so I volunteered my time with the hospice program, working with people who are terminally ill. And in the hospice program, they don't take you in until you have, unless you're diagnosed, 6 months or less to live. So all the folks I was going to be working with were going to be short term. Now, my God loves to do bank shots just to show off, you know. The very first guy that I go out to work with is an angry 72-year-old guy. And I said, what are you angry about? And he said, you wouldn't understand. And I said, why don't you share it with me? So after some coaxing, he said, okay. He said, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober 39 years. And I should have gotten a 39-year kick 2 months ago. And I'm too weak from this medicine to go. And I said, wow, I said, we said some other words, we're off color. I'll say, wow, it's AA approved. It is, it still is. But I said to him, do you know how to load up on that stuff, or did you forget? And he said, no, I can load up. So he loaded up, and I took him to a noontime meeting, and I gave him a 39-year cake. And he was one of the guys who helped, along with Sybil and Tex and those guys, start the Hole in the Ground meeting in L.A. And as God would have it, and I guess he knew I needed it at the time, I needed that connection, he lived another whole year. And I got to give him a 40-year cake. And to be very candid with you, that guy taught me more about living laying down than a lot of people I know who have the ability to come and go as they please. He taught me the true meaning of life, which is to live every second of it. Don't waste a second. Don't be angry and resentful. You don't have the time. This is real, real fast when you look back on it. And I have a lot of guys who call me up, whimpers and whiners, you know. Ken, she's leaving. Ken, I lost my job, you know. So I say, come on over, and I'll spend some time with you. But first, we got a commitment to Stanley. We got to go see Stanley. So I get him over, and then I take him in my car. I learned that from Al-Anon. And I take these guys down to see Stanley, and at that time, Stanley had a colostomy, and he was on intravenous feeding, and he had very little breath, and he was on oxygen all the time. And I bring these little bozos in. And I'd say, Stanley, this guy's having problems with the program. And Stanley would perk up just like a reaction. He'd tear that mask off. And he'd start selling the program. Are you kidding? Are we lucky or what? Another day in sobriety in California. Rah, rah. And he'd go on two or three minutes till the oxygen ran out. And then Stanley would go back into this transcendental meditation state. And we'd sit there and we'd visit with him for about 45 minutes or an hour. And then when we got outside, I looked this guy right in the eye and I said, now tell me about your problems. And you know, most of us don't have problems. I know that's going to upset some. Don't get mad at me. You'll have to pray for me and that will really screw you up. But the deal is that most of us don't. You know, I go to meetings and I hear all kinds of psycho drivel. And I say to people things like, do you have a place to sleep tonight? Have you eaten today? Are you reasonably healthy? And when you have those kind of things where you can say, yes, that all applies to me, sometimes we just don't know what we want. We sometimes feel like we're deserving of so much more. And it's hard to tell this to people, but you say, how can you pray for more when you don't appreciate what you have? One of the things you learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, it's like a cornerstone, and that is when you look around and see people who are happy, joyous, and free, they're full of gratitude. Those are the people who are happy, joyous, and free. They're full of gratitude. And those that aren't happy, joyous, and free ain't full of gratitude. You know? It's like, well, I thought I'd be a million ahead of this, you know. I heard a guy take a cake 5 years sober, and he said, tonight, I'm going to have to sleep in my car. And I was sitting there with a newcomer who said, boy, I wish I had a car. You know? So everything is perceptional, you know, it really is. It's real hard to tell people things like what's true in your mind is true in its consequence, even if it isn't true. You know, if you believe it to be true and you start living your life like it's true, it might as well be true. It might as well be true. There's a guy, Isaac Newton, who was a pretty sharp guy. He was sitting under a tree and he got hit on the head with an apple. Wonder what he said. Wow. And Sir Isaac noticed that apples always fall down. And so he discovered gravity. Discovered gravity after man had been on the earth several thousands of years. He didn't invent it, he just discovered it. It was there all along. Apples always fell down. And you know, if you study science, which a lot of people like to get into, there's a law of opposites. If gravity pulls you down, there must be a force to pull us up. And I found that force in this room. I found that force. I found it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not rooms that are like Alcoholics Anonymous, not programs that have 12 steps like Alcoholics Anonymous, not similar to Alcoholics Anonymous. I found it in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And I heard a kid say it best, I love kids, before they're tampered with, you know? Because there's no doubt when these kids are sent out from the home office, they're perfect. They have great responses. They're so simple. You know, I remember saying to a kid one time, why are you scratching your head? And he said, because I'm the only one who knows it itches. You know? Now that's a simple kid. Yeah. That's real easy. I can understand that and relate to it. But we have an area down in our area where it's Seaport Village where you can professionally mug people. You know, they have all these stores and people go down there and shop. And they have low-flying clouds down there and they have an area that's all green and the kids go out there and they fly all these kites. And last year I remember going up to a kid and his kite was above the clouds and we had low clouds that day. And I said, how do you know your kite's still there? And this 11-year, 12-year-old kid looked me right in the eye and he said, it's easy, mister. I can feel the pull of it. And you know, since I've been sober and I'm on the right track, I can feel the pull of it. When I'm doing the things that I know God wants me to do, no one has to tell me. I just feel the pull of it. And the opposite of that is also true. If I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I can feel the pull of that too. And life has gotten real, real simple. This is the best it's ever been for me. I have two kids that are grown. I'm a grandfather now. I have kids that don't have any problem with this disease, which I'm really grateful for. I have a son who's doing some TV work. I get a chance to see that little snot on TV once in a while. He's an actor. I said to him a couple of weeks ago, Keith, what's the definition of theater? He knows everything, this kid. It's not worth anything. But he said, theater, Dad, is when you suspend reality and you tell a story. I said, my God, every alcoholic I know is in theater, you know? And I have a chance to watch people who have come in after me, just like I have a chance to watch people who have been here before me, and I watch them what they do with their lives, and it's just fantastic. You know, people come out of Dixie dumpsters and they become district attorney. We have that happen. You know, people say things like, you know, do you believe in miracles? And I say, no, in AA we rely on them. You know, there's absolutely no way you can explain what takes place here. And you learn to laugh a lot because you realize other people are laughing at you. You know, it's like, and if you're having a good time, be prepared to take some flack. Because there are some people who just don't want you to be happy, joyous, and free. Because if you're happy, joyous, and free all the time, they'll say, you can't be that way all the time. I love it. If you're that way all the time, then they have no excuse for being miserable all the time. You know? And it gets so easy. And you get to listen here, and you get to find out what's real. The book talks about it. It says deep down inside each one of us is the great reality. And it's only there that you can find it. It's inside. It's not outside. You know, I feel like I got a sign going in that says entrance and a sign coming out that says exit. And the stuff in my life that means the most today is the stuff that comes from my heart. Love, God, you know, fellowship, the program. Those things that you can't define to anyone. People are always trying to define God. You can't define God or love. That would be putting limits on it. It's beyond limits. And you watch things happen at AA meetings, you know. We laugh when we should cry, and we cry when we should laugh, and we call it AA. Somebody comes in and tells a horrendous story, and everybody's cracked up, you know. And then the couch burned, and the house, and, you know, it's like, oh. Did you ever notice that? People will often say to me, Ken, you are so crazy. And I say, yeah, you know, I am insane. And it works for me. A lot of people can't cope with it, you know? But it works for me. I've tried being sane. I've tried holding life out here. I've tried getting secure from things out there. And you know what? I've lost them all. And thank God I did, because if I hadn't lost them, I wouldn't have seen what was really important. Everything that was taken out of my life, regardless of how bad it seemed at the time, turned out to be great. When I came to my first AA meeting in New York and all this stuff was coming down, I didn't say, oh, wow, you know, 20 years from now I'll be up there in Sacramento watching Four Seasons in an hour. You know, you know, I didn't say that. And there's so much craziness going on. You know, you get a chance to just be tuned into it. They got this ad on now with the raisin singing. And I visualize an alcoholic waking up, you know, and seeing that, you know. And thinking, God, the Temptations didn't age well, you know, like that. You know? And you just get tuned into this stuff, you know. We used to sing songs like, I'm just 2 6-packs away from loving you. And, my favorite was, I used to kiss her on the lips, but it's all over now. And the deal is you learn to live totally in the moment. Did you ever realize that? That's all we have. That's eternity. When I'm in the presence of God, I'm not going to be looking at my watch. This is eternity. Now backwards is one. When you can start living every moment in the now, you've won. It's just, that's the way it is. And it gets so easy. People say things like, what are your goals? I don't have any. What are your objectives? I don't have any. What are you going to do today? I'm going to live totally this day. Well, if you want to lose, you know, you want to be a loser all your life. I mean, I see things on my resume when I got here, the thing I did best was start over. You know? It looked like, you know, 6 weeks on the job, he's leaving. I used to love when they gave you your termination notice. That was always the best week on the job. We expect you to come in early tomorrow, even though we terminated you. Oh, yeah, you wait at the door, I'm going to be here bright and early. You know, Remember when you're newly sober and you sit down and you're filling out a job application and they say things like, who are your closest friends? And you know all these people by their first name and their telephone number. You don't know anybody's last name. You don't know where they live. You just have a phone number. I mean, guy said, where do you see yourself 10 years from now? Oh, let me get out my decade at a time. It's totally amazing. Just totally amazing. And you have to learn to listen here. And listen to the end. There's a tendency sometimes when someone is talking or sharing that you give them credit for knowing what's going on. Sometimes when a person starts sharing, they have no more idea what they're going to say than you have. And they have to hear themselves say the word so that they understand what's going on. And if you cut them off too soon or you give them a quick solution, you could be sending them down a road that will keep busy for 2 years that has absolutely nothing to do with them. It's like the guy who was 85 who showed up at the sperm center. And the lady said, "You're 85 years old, sir." He says, "I want to make a deposit." So she gave him a jar, and he went down the hall, and he was gone a half hour, and she got a little shaky, so she went down, knocked at the door, and she heard this voice say, "Come in." So she walked in, and there he was in a heap in the corner, and he looked at her, and he said, "Miss," he said, "I've used my right hand." He said, "I've used my left hand." He said, "I even banged it off the wall." He said, "I can't get the lid off this jar." Now, it would be real easy to jump in there and say, "Well, you should go to more meetings." I want to get you out of here. I want to tell you a story. My mom was a hero in my life. And I tell you that nobody in my family made this program. And the end result of that was in 85, I had a sister who went into the hospital in October of 85. And she hemorrhaged with cirrhosis and died Christmas Day of 85. And we buried her. And a week later to the day, New Year's Day, I lost a brother. My dad died at 50 from this. I lost two sisters in their 30s. I laugh a lot at this, because if I started crying, I wouldn't stop. You know, just the way it is. And when they went, they didn't even know what was killing them. They didn't know. And here a little bozo like me gets a chance to come off the street with a tremendous ego, no sense of direction, not a whole lot of working habits and living habits, and I get a chance to stand still and be sober one day at a time, for which I am terribly grateful. And as Sandy said starting out, there's no way you can pay that back. And I want to tell you a little story my mom used to tell, because it sums up how simple spiritual things can be. My mom had a great Irish brogue. She used to tell this story about Johnny. And Johnny went to a parochial school, and right next to the parochial school was a church. And he would run in there in the morning, and he'd kneel down, and he'd say, "Hello, God, this is Johnny. I just want to tell you I'm here." And then he'd boogie. And then he'd go in at noon, and he'd go in after school, and he'd say the exact same thing. "Hello, God, this is Johnny. I just want to tell you I'm here." And he went weekends and holidays and summers. That was how simple it was for him. And then she told the story, when he was 12, he contracted polio, and at that time there was no cure. And he was in a room, and he was dying. And he was surrounded by his friends, and his chums, and his parents. And my mom said a voice was heard to say, "Hello, Johnny, this is God. I just want to tell you, I'm here." And when I was drinking, I couldn't be there for the people I loved and cared for. Being sober, whenever anyone anywhere reaches out, I can go, or you can go. It doesn't make any difference who we send. The message is the same. Come on in. Sit down. You're welcome. It's going to be okay. That's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other people. It's not about promotions. It's not about being president of GM. It's not about looking down my nose at someone who's having a tough time. It's not about being insensitive to what other people are experiencing. It's about being there. I don't have to know anything. Just be there and hold them and tell them it's going to be okay. And when you've been through a few situations where people slip away, and I've seen that now in this volunteer program, I've worked with nothing but alcoholics. God does have a sense of humor. And I went to the cemetery roughly 12 times in an 18-month period. And I can tell you all the headstones are exactly alike. It has your name. It has the date you were born, a dash, and the date you die. And I don't care if you live 100 years, that dash isn't more than 4 or 5 inches. And we're all in the dash. And some of us are pretty far along. And we don't have the time to be resentful and angry and figuring things out. We just have this day, this moment, to do God's work. Take good care of one another. We're only on loan. God bless you.